to the point of pain, to the point of sickness. His many hidden sufferings make him revolt against the noble taste which seems to deny suffering. The skepticism with regard to suffering, fundamentally only an attitude of aristocratic morality, was not the least of the causes, also of the last great slave insurrection which began with the French Revolution. Wherever the religious neuroses has appeared on the earth so far, we find it connected with three dangerous prescriptions as to regimen: solitude, fasting, and sexual abstinence, but without its being possible to determine with certainty which is cause and which is effect, or if any relation at all of cause and effect exists there. The latter doubt is justified by the fact that one of the most regular symptoms among savage as well as among civilized peoples is the most sudden and excessive sensuality, which then, with equal suddenness, transforms into penitential paroxysms, world renunciation and will renunciation, both symptoms perhaps explainable as disguised epilepsy. But nowhere is it more obligatory to put aside explanations. Around no other type has there grown such a mass of absurdity and superstition. No other type seems to have been more interesting to men, and even to philosophers. Perhaps it is time to become just a little indifferent here, to learn caution, or better still, to look away, to go away. Yet, in the background of the most recent philosophy, that of Schopenhauer, we find almost as the problem in itself this terrible note of interrogation of the religious crisis and awakening. How is the negation of will possible? How is the saint possible? That seems to have been the very question with which Schopenhauer made a start and became a philosopher. And thus, it was a genuine Schopenhauerian consequence that his most convinced adherent, perhaps also his last, as far as Germany is concerned, namely Richard Wagner, should bring his own life work to an end just there, and should finally put that terrible and eternal type upon the stage as Kundry, type Vecchio, a type that has lived, and as it loved and lived, at the very time that the mad doctors in almost all European countries had an opportunity to study the type close at hand, wherever the religious neurosis, or as I call it, the religious mood, made its latest epidemical outbreak and display as the Salvation Army. If it be a question, however, as to what has been so extremely interesting to men of all sorts in all ages and even to philosophers in the whole phenomenon of the saint, it is undoubtedly the appearance of the miraculous therein, namely the immediate succession of opposites, of states of the soul regarded as morally antithetical. It was believed here to be self-evident that a bad man was all at once turned into a saint, a good man. The hitherto existing psychology was wrecked at this point. It is not possible, it may have happened principally because psychology had placed itself under the dominion of morals, because it believed in oppositions of moral values and saw, read, and interpreted these oppositions into the text and facts of the case. What? Miracle? Only an error of interpretation? A lack of philology? It seems that the Latin races are far more deeply attached to their Catholicism than we Northerners are to Christianity generally, and that consequently, unbelief in Catholic countries means something quite different from what it does among Protestants, namely, a sort of revolt against the spirit of the race, while with us, it is rather a return to the spirit or non-spirit of the race. We Northerners undoubtedly derive our origin from barbarous races, even as regards our talent for religion. We have poor talents for it. One may make an exception in the case of the Celts, who have therefore furnished also the best soil for Christian infection in the North. The Christian ideal blossomed forth in France as much as ever the pale sun of the North would allow it. How strangely pious, for our taste, are still these later French skeptics whenever there is any Celtic blood in their origin. How Catholic, how un-German does Auguste Comte's sociology seem to us with the Roman logic of its instincts. How Jesuitical that amiable and shrewd Cicerone of Port Royal, Sainte-Beuve, and in spite of all his hostility to Jesuits, and even Ernest Renan, how inaccessible to us Northerners does the language of such a Renan appear, in whom every instant the merest touch of religious thrill throws his refined, voluptuous, and comfortably couching soul off its balance. Let us repeat after him these fine sentences, and what wickedness and haughtiness is immediately aroused by way of answer in our probably less beautiful but harder souls, that is to say, in our more German souls. So, let us make bold to say that religion is a product of the normal man, that man is closest to the truth when he is most religious and most certain of an infinite destiny. It is when he is good that he wants virtue to correspond to an eternal order. It is when he contemplates things in a disinterested manner that he finds death revolting and absurd. How can we but suppose that it is in moments like this that man sees best. These sentences are so extremely antipodal to my ears and habits of thought that in my first impulse of rage on finding them, I wrote on the margin, "The height of religious nonsense." Until in my later rage, I even took a fancy to them, these sentences with their truth absolutely inverted. It is so nice and such a distinction to have one's own antipodes. That which is so astonishing in the religious life of the ancient Greeks is the irresistible stream of gratitude which it pours forth. It is a very superior kind of man who takes such an attitude towards nature and life. Later on, when the populace got the upper hand in Greece, fear became rampant also in religion, and Christianity was preparing itself. The Passion for God. There are churlish, honest-hearted, and importunate kinds of it, like that of Luther. The whole of Protestantism lacks the southern delicatezza. There is an oriental exaltation of the mind in it, like that of an undeservedly favored or elevated slave, as in the case of St. Augustine, for example, who lacks in an offensive manner all nobility in bearing and desires. There is a feminine tenderness and sensuality in it, which modestly and unconsciously longs for a mystical and physical union, as in the case of Madame de Guyon. In many cases, it appears, curiously enough, as the disguise of a girl's or youth's puberty, here and there, even as the hysteria of an old maid, also as her last ambition. The Church has frequently canonized the women in such a case. The mightiest men have hitherto always bowed reverently before the saint as the enigma of self-subjugation and utter voluntary privation. Why did they thus bow? They divined in him, and as it were behind the questionableness of his frail and wretched appearance, the superior force which wished to test itself by such a subjugation, the strength of will in which they recognized their own strength and love of power and knew how to honor it. They honored something in themselves when they honored the saint. In addition to this, the contemplation of the saint suggested to them a suspicion. Such an enormity of self-negation and anti-naturalness will not have been coveted for nothing, they have said inquiringly. There is perhaps a reason for it, some very great danger about which the aesthetic might wish to be more accurately informed through his secret interlocutors and visitors. In a word, the mighty ones of the world learned to have a new fear before him. They divined a new power, a strange, still unconquered enemy. It was the will to power which obliged them to halt before the saint. They had to question him. In the Jewish Old Testament, the book of divine justice, there are men, things, and sayings on such an immense scale that Greek and Indian literature has nothing to compare with it. One stands with fear and reverence before those stupendous remains of what man was formerly. And one has sad thoughts about old Asia and its little outpushed peninsula Europe, which would like by all means to figure before Asia as the progress of mankind. To be sure, he who is himself only a slender, tame house animal and knows only the wants of a house animal, like our cultured people of today, including the Christians of cultured Christianity, need neither be amazed nor even sad amid these ruins. The taste for the Old Testament is a touchstone with respect to great and small. Perhaps he will find that the New Testament, the Book of Grace, still appeals more to his heart. There is much of the odor of the genuine, tender, stupid beadsman and petty soul in it. To have bound up this New Testament, a kind of rococo of taste in every respect, along with the Old Testament into one book, as the Bible, as the book in itself, is perhaps the greatest audacity and sin against the Spirit which literary Europe has upon its conscience. Why atheism nowadays? The Father in God is thoroughly refuted. Equally so, the Judge, the Rewarder. Also, his free will. He does not hear, and even if he did, he would not know how to help. The worst is that he seems incapable of communicating himself clearly. Is he uncertain? This is what I have made out by questioning and listening at a variety of conversations to be the cause of the decline of European theism. It appears to me that though the religious instinct is in vigorous growth, it rejects the theistic satisfaction with profound distrust. What does all modern philosophy mainly do? Since Descartes, and indeed more in defiance of him than on the basis of his procedure, an attentat has been made on the part of all philosophers on the old conception of the soul, under the guise of a criticism of the subject and predicate conception, that is to say, an attentat on the fundamental presupposition of Christian doctrine. Modern philosophy, as epistemological skepticism, is secretly or openly anti-Christian, although, for keener ears, be it said, by no means anti-religious. Formerly, in effect, one believed in the soul, as one believed in grammar and the grammatical subject. One said, I is the condition, think is the predicate and is condition, to think is an activity for which one must suppose a subject as cause. The attempt was then made, with marvelous tenacity and subtlety, to see if one could not get out of this net, to see if the opposite was not perhaps true. Think the condition, and I the conditioned. I, therefore, only a synthesis which has been made by thinking itself. Kant really wished to prove that, starting from the subject could not be proved, nor the object either. The possibility of an apparent existence of the subject, and therefore of the soul, may not always have been strange to him. The thought which once had an immense power on earth as the Vendetta philosophy. There is a great ladder of religious cruelty with many rounds, but three of these are the most important. Once on a time, men sacrificed human beings to their God, and perhaps just those they loved the best. To this category belong the firstling sacrifices of all primitive religions, and also the sacrifice of the Emperor Tiberius in the Mithra Grotto on the island of Capri, that most terrible of all Roman anachronisms. Then, during the moral epoch of mankind, they sacrificed to their God the strongest instincts they possessed, their nature. This festal joy shines in the cruel glances of ascetics and anti-natural fanatics. Finally, what still remained to be sacrificed? Was it not necessary in the end for men to sacrifice everything comforting, holy, healing, all hope, all faith in hidden harmonies, in future blessedness and justice? Was it not necessary to sacrifice God himself and, out of cruelty to themselves, to worship stone, stupidity, gravity, fate, nothingness? To sacrifice God for nothingness? This paradoxical mystery of the ultimate cruelty has been reserved for the rising generation. We all know something thereof already. Whoever, like myself, prompted by some enigmatical desire, has long endeavored to go to the bottom of the question of pessimism and free it from the half-Christian, half-German narrowness and stupidity in which it has finally presented itself to this century, namely, in the form of Schopenhauer's philosophy, whoever, with an Asiatic and super-Asiatic eye, has actually looked inside and into the most world-renouncing of all possible modes of thought, beyond good and evil, and no longer like Buddha and Schopenhauer under the dominion and delusion of morality. Whoever has done this has perhaps just thereby, without really deigning it, opened his eyes to behold the opposite ideal, the ideal of the most world-approving, exuberant, and vivacious man, who has not only learned to compromise and arrange with that which was and is, but wishes to have it again as it was and is, for all eternity, insatiably calling out de capo, from the beginning, not only to himself, but to the whole piece and play, and not only the play, but actually to him who requires the play, and makes it necessary, because he always requires himself anew, and makes himself necessary. What? And this would not be God as vicious circle? The distance and, as it were, the space around man grows with the strength of his intellectual vision and insight. His world becomes profounder. New stars, new enigmas and notions are ever coming into view. Perhaps everything on which the intellectual eye has exercised its acuteness and profundity has just been an occasion for its exercise, something of a game, something for children and childish minds. Perhaps the most solemn conceptions that have caused the most fighting and suffering, the conceptions of God and sin, will one day seem to us of no more importance than a child's plaything or a child's pain seems to an old man. And perhaps another plaything and another pain will then be necessary once more for the old man, always childish enough, an eternal child. Has it been observed to what extent outward idleness or semi-idleness is necessary to a real religious life? Alike for its favorite microscopic labor of self-examination and for its soft placidity called prayer, the state of perpetual readiness for the coming of God. I mean, the idleness with good conscience, the idleness of olden times and of blood, to which the aristocratic sentiment that work is dishonoring, that it vulgarizes body and soul, is not quite unfamiliar, and that consequently the modern, noisy, time-engrossing, conceited, foolishly proud laboriousness educates and prepares for unbelief more than anything else. Among these, for instance, who are at present living apart from religion in Germany, I find free thinkers of diversified species and origin, but, above all, a majority of those in whom laboriousness from generation to generation has dissolved the religious instincts, so that they no longer know what purpose religions serve, and only note their existence in the world with a kind of dull astonishment. They feel themselves already fully occupied, these good people, be it by their business or by their pleasures, not to mention the fatherland and the newspapers and their family duties. It seems that they have no time whatever left for religion, and above all, it is not obvious to them whether it is a question of a new business or a new pleasure. For it is impossible, they say to themselves, that people should go to church merely to spoil their temper. They are by no means enemies of religious customs. Should certain circumstances, state affairs perhaps, require their participation in such customs, they do what is required, as so many things are done, with a patient and unassuming seriousness, and without much curiosity or discomfort. They live too much apart and outside to feel even the necessity for a for and against in such matters. Among those indifferent persons may be reckoned nowadays the majority of German Protestants of the middle classes, especially in the great laborious centers of trade and commerce. Also, the majority of laborious scholars and the entire university personnel, with the exception of the theologians, whose existence and possibility there always gives psychologists new and more subtle puzzles to solve. On the part of pious, or merely church-going people, there is seldom any idea of how much goodwill, one might say arbitrary will, is now necessary for a German scholar to take the problem of religion seriously. His whole profession, and, as I have said, his whole workmanlike laboriousness to which he is compelled by his modern conscience, inclines him to a lofty and almost charitable serenity as regards religion, with which is occasionally mingled a slight disdain for the uncleanliness of spirit which he takes for granted whenever anyone still professes to belong to the church. It is only with the help of history, not through his own personal experience, therefore, that the scholar succeeds in bringing himself to a respectful seriousness and to a certain timid deference in presence of religions. But even when his sentiments have reached the stage of gratitude towards them, he has not personally advanced one step nearer to that which still maintains itself as church or as piety, perhaps even the contrary. The practical indifference to religious matters in the midst of which he has been born and brought up usually sublimates itself in his case into circumspection and cleanliness, which shuns contact with religious men and things. And it may be just the depth of his tolerance and humanity which prompts him to avoid the delicate trouble which tolerance itself brings with it. Every age has its own divine type of naivete, for the discovery of which other ages may envy it. And how much naivete, adorable, childlike, and boundlessly foolish naivete, is involved in this belief of the scholar in his superiority, in the good conscience of his tolerance, in the unsuspecting, simple certainty with which his instinct treats the religious man as a lower and less valuable type, beyond, before, and above which he himself has developed. He, the little arrogant dwarf and mob man, the sedulously alert head and hand drudge of ideas and modern ideas. Whoever has seen deeply into the world has doubtless divined what wisdom there is in the fact that men are superficial. It is their preservative instinct which teaches them to be flighty, lightsome, and false. Here and there, one finds a passionate and exaggerated adoration of pure forms in philosophers as well as in artists. It is not to be doubted that whoever has need of the cult of the superficial to that extent has, at one time or another, made an unlikely dive beneath it. Perhaps there is even an order of rank with respect to those burnt children, the born artists, who find the enjoyment of life only in trying to falsify its image, as if taking wearisome revenge on it. One might guess to what degree life has disgusted them by the extent to which they wish to see its image falsified, attenuated, ultrified, and deified. One might reckon the religious man among the artists as their highest rank. It is the profound, suspicious fear of an incurable pessimism which compels whole centuries to fasten their teeth into a religious interpretation of existence. The fear of the instinct which divines that truth might be attained too soon, before man has become strong enough, hard enough, artist enough. Piety, the life in God, regarded in this light, would appear as the most elaborate and ultimate product of the fear of truth, as artist adoration and artist intoxication in presence of the most logical of all falsifications, as the will to the inversion of truth, to untruth at any price. Perhaps there has hitherto been no more effective means of beautifying man than piety. By means of it, man can become so artful, so superficial, so iridescent, and so good that his appearance no longer offends. to love mankind for God's sake. This has so far been the noblest and remotest sentiment to which mankind has attained. That love to mankind without any redeeming intention in the background is only an additional folly and brutishness. That the inclination to this love has first to get its proportion, its delicacy, its gram of salt and sprinkling of ambergris from a higher inclination. Whoever first perceived and experienced this, however his tongue may have stammered, as it attempted to express such a delicate matter, let him for all time be holy and respected as the man who has so far flown highest and gone astray in the finest fashion. The philosopher, as we free spirits understand him, as the man of the greatest responsibility, who has the conscience for the general development of mankind, will use religion for his disciplining and educating work, just as he will use the contemporary political and economic conditions. The selecting and disciplining influence, destructive as well as creative and fashioning, which can be exercised by means of religion, is manifold and varied, according to the sort of people placed under its spell and protection. For those who are strong and independent, destined and trained to command, in whom the judgment and skill of a ruling race is incorporated, religion is an additional means for overcoming resistance in the exercise of authority, as a bond which binds rulers and subjects in common, betraying and surrendering to the former the conscience of the latter, their inmost heart, which would fain escape obedience. And, in the case of the unique natures of noble origin, if by virtue of superior spirituality they should incline to a more retired and contemplative life, reserving to themselves only the more refined forms of government over chosen disciples or members of an order, religion itself may be used as a means for obtaining peace from the noise and trouble of managing grosser affairs, and for securing immunity from the unavoidable filth of all political agitation. The Brahmins, for instance, understood this fact. With the help of a religious organization, they secured to themselves the power of nominating kings for the people, while their sentiments prompted them to keep apart and outside as men with a higher and super-regal mission. At the same time, religion gives inducement and opportunity to some of the subjects to qualify themselves for future ruling and commanding the slowly ascending ranks and classes, in which, though fortunate marriage customs, volitional power, and delight in self-control are on the increase. To them, religion offers sufficient incentives and temptations to aspire to higher intellectuality and to experience the sentiments of authoritative self-control, of silence, and of solitude. Asceticism and Puritanism are almost indispensable means of educating and ennobling a race which seeks to rise above its hereditary baseness and work itself upwards to future supremacy. And finally, to ordinary men, to the majority of the people who exist for service and general utility and are only so far entitled to exist, religion gives invaluable contentedness with their lot and condition, peace of heart, ennoblement of obedience, additional social happiness and sympathy, with something of transfiguration and embellishment, something of justification for all the commonplaceness, all the meanness, all the semi-animal poverty of their souls. Religion, together with the religious significance of life, sheds sunshine over such perpetually harassed men and makes even their own aspect endurable to them. It operates upon them as the Epicurean philosophy usually operates upon sufferers of a higher order, in a refreshing and refining manner, almost turning suffering to account, and in the end even hallowing and vindicating it. There is perhaps nothing so admirable in Christianity and Buddhism as their art of teaching even the lowest to elevate themselves by piety to a seemingly higher order of things, and thereby to retain their satisfaction with the actual world in which they find it difficult enough to live, this very difficulty being necessary. to be sure, to make also the bad counter-reckoning against such religions, and to bring to light their secret dangers. The cost is always excessive and terrible when religions do not operate as an educational and disciplinary medium in the hands of the philosopher, but rule voluntarily and paramountly when they wish to be the final end and not a means along with other means. Among men, as among all other animals, there is a surplus of defective, diseased, degenerating, infirm, and necessarily suffering individuals. The successful cases among men also are always the exception, and in view of the fact that man is the animal not yet properly adapted to his environment, the rare exception. But worse still, the higher the type a man represents, the greater is the improbability that he will succeed. The accidental, the law of irrationality in the general constitution of mankind manifests itself most terribly in its destructive effect on the higher orders of men, the conditions of whose lives are delicate, diverse, and difficult to determine. What, then, is the attitude of the two greatest religions above mentioned to the surplus of failures in life? They endeavor to preserve and keep alive whatever can be preserved. In fact, as the religions for sufferers, they take the part of these upon principle. They are always in favor of those who suffer from life as from a disease, and they would fain treat every other experience of life as false and impossible. However highly we may esteem this indulgent and preservative care, inasmuch as in applying to others it has applied, and applied also to the highest and usually the most suffering type of man, the hitherto paramount religions, to give a general appreciation of them, are among the principal causes which have kept the type of man upon a lower level. They have preserved too much that which should have perished. One has to thank them for invaluable services, and who is sufficiently rich in gratitude not to feel poor at the contemplation of all that the spiritual men of Christianity have done for Europe hitherto? But when they have given comfort to the sufferers, courage to the oppressed and despairing, a staff and support to the helpless, and when they had allured from society into convents and spiritual penitentiaries the broken-hearted and distracted, what else had they to do in order to work systematically in that fashion and with a good conscience for the preservation of all the sick and suffering, which means, in deed and in truth, to work for the deterioration of the European race, to reverse all estimates of value? That is what they had to do. And to shatter the strong, to spoil great hopes, to cast suspicion on the delight in beauty, to break down everything autonomous, manly, conquering, and imperious, all instincts which are natural to the highest and most successful type of man, into uncertainty, distress of conscience, and self-destruction. Forsooth, to invert all love of the earthly and of supremacy over the earth into hatred of the earth and earthly things. That is the task the Church imposed on itself, and was obliged to impose until, according to its standard of value, unworldliness, unsensuousness, and higher man fused into one sentiment. If one could observe the strangely painful, equally coarse and refined comedy of European Christianity with the derisive and impartial eye of an Epicurean god, I should think one would never cease marveling and laughing. Does it not actually seem that some single will has ruled over Europe for 18 centuries in order to make a sublime abortion of man? He, however, who, with opposite requirements, no longer Epicurean, and with some divine hammer in his hand, could approach this almost voluntary degeneration and stunting of mankind, as exemplified in the European Christian, Pascal, for instance, would he not have to cry aloud with rage, pity, and horror? Oh, you bunglers, presumptuous, pitiful bunglers, what have you done? Was that a work for your hands? How you have hacked and botched my finest stone, what have you presumed to do? I should say that Christianity has hitherto been the most portentous of presumption. Men not great enough nor hard enough to be entitled as artists to take part in fashioning man. Men not sufficiently strong and far-sighted to allow, with sublime self-constraint, the obvious law of the thousandfold failures and perishings to prevail. Men not sufficiently noble to see the radically different grades of rank and intervals of rank that separate man from man. Such men, with their equality before God, have hitherto swayed the destiny of Europe, until at last a dwarfed, almost ludicrous species has been produced, a gregarious animal, something obliging, sickly, mediocre, the European of the present day. Chapter 4. Apothems and Interludes. He who is a thorough teacher takes things seriously, and even himself, only in relation to his pupils. Knowledge for its own sake, that is the last snare laid by morality. We are thereby completely entangled in morals once more. The charm of knowledge would be small were it not so much shame has to be overcome on the way to it. We are most dishonorable towards our God. He is not permitted to sin. The tendency of a person to allow himself to be degraded, robbed, deceived, and exploited might be the difference of a God among men. Love to one only is a barbarity, for it is exercised at the expense of all others, love to God also. I did that, says my memory. I could not have done that, says my pride, and remains inexorable. Eventually, the memory yields. One has regarded life carelessly if one has failed to see the hand that kills with leniency. If a man has character, he has also his typical experience, which always recurs. The sage as astronomer. So long as thou feelest the stars as an above thee, thou lackest the eye of the discerning one. It is not the strength, but the duration of great sentiments that makes great men. He who attains his ideal precisely thereby surpasses it. Many a peacock hides his tail from every eye and calls it his pride. A man of genius is unbearable unless he possess at least two things besides, gratitude and purity. The degree and nature of a man's sensuality extends to the highest altitudes of his spirit. Under peaceful conditions, the militant man attacks himself. With his principles, a man seeks either to dominate or justify or honor or reproach or conceal his habits. Two men with the same principles probably seek fundamentally different ends therewith. He who despises himself nevertheless esteems himself thereby as a despiser. A soul which knows that it is loved but does not itself love betrays its sediment, its dregs come up. A thing that is explained ceases to concern us. What did God mean who gave the advice, know thyself? Did it perhaps imply, cease to be concerned about thyself, become objective, and Socrates, and a scientific man? It is terrible to die of thirst at sea. Is it necessary that you should so salt your truth that it will no longer quench thirst? Sympathy for all would be harshness and tyranny for thee, my good neighbor. Instinct. When the house is on fire, one forgets even the dinner, yes, but one recovers it from among the ashes. Woman learns how to hate in proportion as she forgets how to charm. The same emotions are in man and woman, but in different tempo. On that account, man and woman never cease to misunderstand each other. In the background of all their personal vanity, women themselves have still their impersonal scorn for woman. Fettered heart, free spirit. When one firmly fetters one's heart and keeps it prisoner, one can allow one's spirit many liberties. I said this once before, but people do not believe it when I say so unless they know it already. One begins to distrust very clever persons when they become embarrassed. Dreadful experiences raise the question whether he who experiences them is not something dreadful also. Heavy, melancholy men turn lighter and come temporarily to their surface precisely by that which makes others heavy, by hatred and love. So cold, so icy that one burns one's fingers at the touch of him, every hand that lays hold of him shrinks back, and for that very reason many think him red hot. Who has not, at one time or another, sacrificed himself for the sake of his good name? In affability, there is no hatred of men, but precisely on that account, a great deal too much contempt of men. The maturity of man. That means to have reacquired the seriousness that one had as a child at play. To be ashamed of one's immorality is a step on the ladder at the end of which one is ashamed also of one's morality. One should part from life as Ulysses parted from Nausicaa, blessing it rather than in love with it. What? A great man? I always see merely the play actor of his own ideal. When one trains one's conscience, it kisses one while it bites. The disappointed one speaks. I listened for the echo, and I heard only praise. We all feign to ourselves that we are simpler than we are. We thus relax ourselves away from our fellows. A discerning one might easily regard himself at present as the animalization of God. Discovering reciprocal love should really disenchant the lover with regard to the beloved. What, she is modest enough to love even you, or stupid enough, or... The danger in happiness. Everything now turns out best for me. I now love every fate. Who would like to be my fate? Not their love of humanity, but the impotence of their love prevents the Christians of today burning us. The pious fraud is still more repugnant to the taste, the piety, of the free spirit, the pious man of knowledge, than the impious fraud. Hence, the profound lack of judgment in comparison with the church, characteristic of the type free spirit as its non-freedom. By means of music, the very passions enjoy themselves. A sign of strong character when once the resolution has been taken to shut the ear even to the best counter-arguments, occasionally, therefore, a will to stupidity. There is no such thing as moral phenomena, but only a moral interpretation of phenomena. The criminal is often thought not equal to his deed. He extenuates and maligns it. The advocates of a criminal are seldom artists enough to turn the beautiful terribleness of the deed to the advantage of the doer. Our vanity is most difficult to wound just when our pride has been wounded. To him who feels himself preordained to contemplation and not to belief, all believers are too noisy and obtrusive. He guards against them. You want to prepossess him in your favor, then you must be embarrassed before him. The immense expectation with regard to sexual love and the coyness in this expectation spoils all the perspectives of women at the outset. Where there is neither love nor hatred in the game, women's play is mediocre. The great epochs of our life are at the points when we gain courage to rebaptize our badness as the best in us. The will to overcome an emotion is ultimately only the will of another, or of several other emotions. There is an innocence of admiration. It is possessed by him to whom it has not yet occurred that he himself might be admired some day. Our loathing of dirt may be so great as to prevent our cleaning ourselves, justifying ourselves. Sensuality often forces the growth of love too much, so that its root remains weak and is easily torn up. It is a curious thing that God learned Greek when he wished to turn author, and that he did not learn it better. To rejoice on account of praise is in many cases merely politeness of heart and the very opposite of vanity of spirit. Even concubinage has been corrupted by marriage. He who exults at the stake does not triumph over pain, but because of the fact that he does not feel pain where he expected it, a parable. When we have to change an opinion about anyone, we charge heavily to his account the inconvenience he thereby causes us. A nation is a detour of nature to arrive at 6 or 7 great men, yes, and then to get round them. In the eyes of all true women, science is hostile to the sense of shame. They feel as if one wished to peep under their skin with it, or worse still, under their dress and finery. The more abstract the truth you wish to teach, the more must you allure the senses to it. The devil has the most extensive perspectives for God. On that account, he keeps so far away from him, the devil, in effect, as the oldest friend of knowledge. What a person is begins to betray itself when his talent decreases, when he ceases to show what he can do. Talent is also an adornment. An adornment is also a concealment. The sexes deceive themselves about each other. The reason is that in reality they honor and love only themselves, or their own ideal, to express it more agreeably. Thus, man wishes woman to be peaceable, but in fact, woman is essentially unpeaceable, like the cat, however well she may have assumed the peaceable demeanor. One is punished best for one's virtues. He who cannot find the way to his ideal lives more frivolously and shamelessly than the man without an ideal. From the senses originate all trustworthiness, all good conscience, all evidence of truth. Phariseeism is not a deterioration of the good man. A considerable part of it is rather an essential condition of being good. The one seeks an accoucheur for his thoughts. The other seeks someone whom he can assist. A good conversation thus originates. In intercourse with scholars and artists, one readily makes mistakes of opposite kinds. In a remarkable scholar, one not infrequently finds a mediocre man, and often, even in a mediocre artist, one finds a very remarkable man. We do the same when awake as when dreaming. We only invent and imagine him with whom we have intercourse and forget it immediately. In revenge and in love, woman is more barbarous than man. Advice as a riddle. If the band is not to break, bite it first, secure to make. The belly is the reason why man does not so readily take himself for a god. The chastest utterance I ever heard, in true love it is the soul that envelops the body. Our vanity would like what we do best to pass precisely for what is most difficult to us concerning the origin of many systems of morals. When a woman has scholarly inclinations, there is generally something wrong with her sexual nature. Barrenness itself conduces to a certain virility of taste. Man, indeed, if I may say so, is the barren animal. Comparing man and women generally, one may say that woman would not have the genius for adornment if she had not the instinct for the secondary role. He who fights with monsters should be careful lest he thereby become a monster. And if thou gaze long into an abyss, the abyss will also gaze into thee. From old Florentine novels, moreover, from life, good and bad women need the stick. Sacchetti, November 86. To seduce their neighbor to a favorable opinion, and afterwards to believe implicitly in this opinion of their neighbor, who can do this conjuring trick so well as women? That which an age considers evil is usually an unseasonable echo of what was formerly considered good, the atavism of an old ideal. Around the hero, everything becomes a tragedy. Around the demigod, everything becomes a satyr play. And around God, everything becomes, what? Perhaps a world? It is not enough to possess a talent. One must also have your permission to possess it. Eh, my friends? Where there is the tree of knowledge, there is always paradise. So say the most ancient and the most modern serpents. What is done out of love always takes place beyond good and evil. Objection, evasion, joyous distrust, and love of irony are signs of health. Everything absolute belongs to pathology. The sense of the tragic increases and declines with sensuousness. Insanity in individuals is something rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epochs, it is the rule. The thought of suicide is a great consolation. By means of it, one gets successfully through many a bad night. Not only our reason, but also our conscience truckles to our strongest impulse, the tyrant in us. One must repay good and ill, but why just to the person who did us good or ill? One no longer loves one knowledge sufficiently after one has communicated it. Poets act shamelessly toward their experiences. They exploit them. Our fellow creature is not our neighbor, but so thinks every nation. Love brings to light the noble and hidden qualities of a lover, his rare and exceptional traits. It is thus liable to be deceptive as to his normal character. Jesus said to his Jews, "The law was for servants. Love God as I love him, as his son. What have we sons of God to do with morals?" In sight of every party. A shepherd has always need of a bellwether, or he has himself to be a wether occasionally. One may indeed lie with the mouth, but with the accompanying grimace, one nevertheless tells the truth. To vigorous men, intimacy is a matter of shame and something precious. Christianity gave Eros poison to drink. He did not die of it, certainly, but degenerated to vice. To talk much about oneself may also be a means of concealing oneself. In praise, there is more obtrusiveness than in blame. Pity has an almost ludicrous effect on a man of knowledge, like tender hands on a cyclops. One occasionally embraces some one or other out of love to mankind because one cannot embrace all, but this is what one must never confess to the individual. One does not hate as long as one disesteems, but only when one esteems equal or superior. Ye utilitarians, ye too love the useful only as a vehicle for your inclinations. Ye too really find the noise of its wheels insupportable. One loves ultimately one's desires, not the thing desired. The vanity of others is only counter to our taste when it is counter to our vanity. With regard to what truthfulness is, perhaps nobody has ever been sufficiently truthful. One does not believe in the follies of clever men. What a forfeiture of the rights of man! The consequences of our actions seize us by the forelock, very indifferent to the fact that we have meanwhile reformed. There is an innocence in lying, which is the sign of good faith in a cause. It is inhuman to bless when one is being cursed. The familiarity of superiors embitters one, because it may not be returned. I am affected, not because you have deceived me, but because I can no longer believe in you. There is a haughtiness of kindness which has the appearance of wickedness. I dislike him. Why? I am not a match for him. Did anyone ever answer so? Chapter 5. The Natural History of Morals. The moral sentiment in Europe at present is perhaps as subtle, belated, diverse, sensitive, and refined as the science of morals belonging thereto is recent, initial, awkward, and coarse-fingered, an interesting contrast which sometimes becomes incarnate and obvious in the very person of a moralist. Indeed, the expression science of morals is, in respect to what is designated thereby, far too presumptuous and counter to good taste, which is always a foretaste of more modern expressions. One ought to avow, with the utmost fairness, what is still necessary here for a long time, what is alone proper for the present, namely, the collection of material, the comprehensive survey and classification of an immense domain of delicate sentiments of worth and distinctions of worth, which live, grow, propagate and perish, and perhaps attempts to give a clear idea of the recurring and more common forms of these living crystallizations as preparation for a theory of types of morality. To be sure, people have not hitherto been so modest. All the philosophers, with a pedantic and ridiculous seriousness, demanded of themselves something